Welcome to our whistleblower world at Whistleblower Network News. I am your host, Jane Turner, FBI whistleblower and constant whistleblower advocate. We look into the lives of whistleblowers or their advocates, brave souls who are prophets of conscience. President Biden has referred to whistleblowers in the highest of praise, referring to them as accountability actors. I just refer to whistleblowers as heroes.
Hello, this is Jane Turner, and I am so excited today to have FBI Special Agent Steve Friend on. He is a hero and a warrior, or a villain, and we're going to find out today which one he is. Because we also have on his attorney, Dan Meyer, who is known among whistleblower circles. His career is long and storied. He has a private practice now, but he used to be director of whistleblowing and transparency years ago and director of the civilian reprisal investigations about a decade ago. So he's a prominent attorney in Washington, D.C. He's had a lot of experience with whistleblowers, and I'm sure Agent Friend feels lucky to have him on board. Not only do we have Dan Meyer, but we have Jason Foster, the founder and president of Empower Oversight, which is an oversight and investigations that occurred on or can occur on Capitol Hill. He's experienced. He's helped me on my case. I can't say enough good things about Jason. But let's get to what we're talking about today, which is FBI Special Agent Steve Friend. First of all, Dan Meyer has a statement he would like to make. Go ahead, Dan, and make that statement, would you please?
Sure, Jane, and I'm glad to be with you. I'm currently up in New England visiting family graves of veterans who fought in the Revolution and the War of 1812, and we are in perilous times now as we were in perilous times then. Steve is speaking on his own behalf today, not on government time, not as a Bureau spokesman. He is still with the Bureau, and he's in a suspended status on his clearance, pending resolution of a variety of issues. And we are looking to the FBI, particularly the director himself, to ensure that Steven is protected as a source not only for the FBI on internal corruption, but also as a source to the United States Senate. So with that, I'm more than glad to have Steve speak and help explain his position to the American people.
Well, with two powerful war horses like you and Foster, I can't imagine any better defense or advocacy he can have. It's wonderful. So FBI Special Agent Steve Friend, how do you feel today?
I feel pretty good. Like you said, Jason and Dan are formidable in my defense. I also feel pretty relieved that I'm going to be able to actually put my face to the message that I have. I feel like it's something that's important, and I'm willing to stake my career on it.
And you certainly have staked your career on it, and it is important. So let's talk a little bit about you. Let's talk about your history. Before you came in the FBI, a lot of people don't know that most agents have at least 27 years of experience. That's typical 27, 28, up to 32 years of experience before they came in the Bureau. So tell us about yours. What was your life before you came in the FBI?
Well, I hail from Savannah, Georgia. I was born up in New Jersey, but moved there when I was about nine. So that's where I call home. I after graduating high school, went to the University of Notre Dame, was an accounting major there, and just had planned on having a long and storied career in public accounting. one tax season was one too many for me. So at that point decided that I wanted to pursue a completely different option in my career and looked into police work. So in 2009, I got on with the police department for my hometown, for Savannah, and worked as a patrolman there, and also into some narcotics investigations for a number of years. At the same time, simultaneously applying with the FBI, that was another option that had piqued my interest. Actually, as early as college, the FBI had done a presentation to the accounting department at Notre Dame because that was one of the skills that they were seeking. So after a 4-year ordeal of getting through multiple tests and interviews and lie detectors and fitness exams, finally started with the FBI in June 2014.
So June 2014. That's your EOD date, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And I assume you enjoyed all that it had to offer in those training days at Quantico. You obviously flourished. You came out, and what was your first office?
I was assigned to the Omaha field office, and they stationed me in Sioux City, Iowa, about 100 miles north of headquarters city. And my duties, responsibilities there were to investigate violent crimes and major offenses that were occurring on the Indian reservations in northeast Nebraska.
So they must have been pretty confident of your ability, because they don't send a lot of agents right out to resident agencies. And it's a peculiar breed that goes out to work Indian country. So they must have had a high opinion of you at the start.
I like to think so. It's a very small niche of the world in the FBI that investigates Indian reservations. It's only about 150 agents, and you're extremely independent. You have to see cases from start to finish, and they're really depending on you to be a representative of the agency with the local tribal law enforcement there.
That's right. And so they must have thought very highly of you to put you out there first office agent. I know that, since I've worked Indian country. Also, you were on the SWAT team. At what point in your career did that happen? Because that's a process in itself within the FBI. There's a lot of things that go into that, the brotherhood, a band of brothers. When did you get into SWAT?
I went for the SWAT selection for the Omaha team in May of 2016, made it through the selection, and was brought onto the team. Then immediately, you have to go through a SWAT basic school in order to be a fully certified operator, and did that later in November of 2016. And then was on the team until I actually transferred out of the Omaha division to the Jacksonville division in 2021.
So that's where you were at. 2021, you got moved to the Jacksonville office. And what were you assigned there?
So I transferred in June 2021, and the role that I was going to be filling was violent crimes against children. They've rebranded it now to be child exploitation, human trafficking, but essentially it's child pornography investigations.
And did you enjoy that? Here again, you went from a small niche, which is Indian country, to an even smaller niche, which is child exploitation. Not a lot of agents are able to handle that. So did you fit nicely into that niche?
I did. It's one of the few areas, along with the Indian country investigations, that you kind of have the right to beg out of. And there's a process for doing that. It's kind of strange to say you enjoy working child pornography investigations, but it's very rewarding. There's a huge need for it. It's rampant. And I was diving right into that. And because it also allows you to work with local law enforcement hand in glove. And that's something that I find extremely rewarding.
Yes. So here you are sitting great in Jacksonville, working cases that you are good at, that you're doing. So what happened next in your career here? You've got about how many years in at this point?
When I transferred, I had about 7 years in. At this point, I've been in a little over 8. And I actually transferred to the Daytona Beach Resident Agency. I was never in the headquarters city.
Oh, you got a wow. Okay.
So I've been nothing but RA life. And
Highly unusual. Wow. They must, your supervisors must have thought highly of you. They don't go moving first office agents around like that unless they thought highly of you.
Yeah, I had exemplary performance reviews throughout my career, even including my first year in Daytona. Never had a disciplinary problem. I was actually received a performance award in July of 2022. So less than a month before this entire ordeal started, I got an award.
That is outstanding. And it sounds like you're an outstanding agent. And I will tell you, the transfer policy off of Indian Country came through my case. They changed the policy after my case that was settled by the FBI. So I'm very happy for you. I'm very happy for you. They don't let you sit there anymore for years and years and years. So it sounds like you're doing great. You're there. You're in another RA doing stuff that you really enjoy. What happened next? You're working SWAT. They accepted you into the SWAT community at this RA. Doing great. And then what happened?
So my SSRA, my supervisor, he retired around August of 2021, right towards the very end of the fiscal year. So rolling into the new fiscal year, October, got a call from the ASAC, the assistant special agent in charge, one of the three who was working for the Jacksonville field office. He called my acting boss at the time. It was just another agent who was in my office, gave him the news that they were going to decide to move me over to the JTTF, the Joint Terrorism Task Force, focusing on domestic terrorism matters in the Daytona Beach area of responsibility.
Did they ask you, or was it one of those assignments you had no choice?
I was voluntold a little bit. I think that if I had pushed back on having somebody else in the office take that role, it might have happened. But then I would have been moved over into filling their role. So it was going to be moving multiple people as opposed to just one into that slot.
Ah, and so you settled into that. How many cases did you have?
So at the time, I had a fair number of child pornography cases that were active. And I was told that those I could continue to work through and until they were resolved, but mm-hmm. discouraged from taking on more cases because those were going to be considered local matters. I was brought into the national security side of the house, and they had some existing cases. They were all basically derivative from January 6th investigations.
Okay, so that was your introduction to the January 6th investigations, which had occurred prior to you following through on your orders to your RA. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so it all had happened in the past, January 6th. You're sitting there, part of the SWAT team. You've got these new cases. Tell us what happened next.
So there was sort of a balancing act before the new supervisor got stationed to Daytona. So it was just another agent filling those shoes, keeping the ship running. And he said, hey, let's wait for the new boss to get here. Why don't you just make yourself available to work JTTF matters? If anything does pop open, then you're going to be, available to work that. But for the time being, balance that with your existing cases on the child exploitation, and we'll wait for him to arrive.
Sure. And that's totally normal. That's how it works.
So we did that. New boss arrived around the beginning of 2022, spoke to him. He sits down with everybody in the office one-on-one. He had that office space. So what is it that you do here? Mm-hmm. And explain to him this sort of weird dual role that I was playing. And I told him, look, I'm a team guy. If that's what the need is, then I'm there. But I do think that there's a really important need with the child porn cases too. So if it's okay, I'd like to continue doing that sort of like dual track.
And he said, fine, I'm sure, huh?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. And he told me in subsequent conversations that he was pushing back on executive management because of the work that I had done there. It was continuing to do there. The conversations that he was having with the police chiefs and with the sheriffs for the four counties that we were responsible for, they all were saying that, you know, this was a huge need for them and that, you know, I'd worked really well with their investigative arms in that regard. So there was definitely support from the boss to continue to do so. And really the thing when it comes to child pornography investigations, it's pretty easy to kind of push pause on those. If it's not really a threat to life that's going on very often in those. If there is, you know, like a hands-on, then, you know, everything is thrown towards that. But if it's just going to be a matter of looking at the ones and zeros and determining, you know, who your suspect is and where he is, that can be paused if there's a need on national security. So it was working pretty well.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And it sounds like you were embraced by all your management, senior management, by your fellow agents. So things are going great. Something happened here.
Yes. So I was checking in with the other members of the Joint Terrorism Task Force. It was one other special agent and two task force officers, one from a sheriff's office and one from a police department. So it was three others and myself, so four of us, and looked at these January 6th cases that we had. And just coming from the Indian country background, I'm sure you can appreciate, mm-hmm. it's just get them in, get them out, get them in, get them out. Mm-hmm. You will drown unless you are, you know, just continuing to drive on. So my first instinct is, hey guys, what are we doing? What are we doing with this? You know, mm-hmm. if it's nothing to do, then why is it still here?
Right.
The response that I got was, well, we're just waiting for Washington to tell us what to do.
You know, so did you have warrants that had been issued?
No, not to that point. They were waiting to find out if those individuals were going to be charged even. It was up to Washington.
So Agent Friend, were they open cases?
Yes, they were open cases. There was a mix between either a riot investigation, which is actually a criminal issue, even though it was being investigated, national security, or a full domestic terrorism extremist investigation.
So what kind of file openings were there? I never worked very little domestic terrorism, but you're up into the 100 somethings, right, at that mm-hmm. point?
266 were terrorism.
Okay.
176 for riots.
There you go. So it was a combination of the 266 and the 176. They were open, but there was nothing in the files in terms of arrest warrants.
No, there was no arrest warrants, but there had been some interviews done with with these guys.
Okay.
There was surveillance done. There had been, you know, cell phone analysis to see if the person's cell phone was registering the GPS inside the Capitol at that time, facial recognition documentation, looking at their social media. So there was some investigative work done. A lot of it was done actually in Washington and before those cases were pushed over to the field with instructions to, you know, go interview the subject.
So was the Office of Origin Washington?
No.
Who had the Office of Origin tag?
Jacksonville did.
Okay. So did they tell you to open those cases or did you open them on your own, Jacksonville?
So I didn't. They were already open when I came over.
Right.
But the instructions were the guardian leads that came out to the agents were to conduct, you know, necessary investigative activity to determine if a case should be opened.
Okay.
You know, if it's nothing, if it's a mistaken identity, which I, you know, which does happen.
Yes.
You know, person says, hey, I wasn't there. Here's a picture of me with holding a newspaper on January 6th. And you can see I'm drinking Mai Tais in Florida. it's, you know, close it out, send it back.
Yeah. Okay.
But if there was going to be an investigation opened, it was going to be opened Office of Origin, Jacksonville Division, JK.
Okay, so it was Officer of Origin Jacksonville. Gotcha. Well, that's important. That's an important thing. And but you were waiting on Washington to tell you which way to go. Was the United States Attorney involved or the AUSA involved in Jacksonville at all? Or were you taking your orders from Washington?
Washington was working with AUSAs that had been temporarily assigned to this giant capital task force that they have going there.
In Washington. Correct. So yes. There were no AUSAs or the United States Attorney in Jacksonville was not really involved in this. It was all out of headquarters.
All out of headquarters up until the point where if you were going to execute a search warrant, you'd have to get the U.S. Attorney's Office involved locally because they have to get the magistrate here to sign off on a search warrant in our area.
Sure. So you're sitting there and you're kind of saying, what's going on? Let's get some action here. You're on the SWAT. Yeah.
So I'm just wanting to know, why are these cases open if we've already talked to them? And it seemed to me like a reasonable amount of time had elapsed. And well, if we were going to be waiting for Washington, D.C. to make a decision, that just didn't sit right with me in general, because I'm pretty familiar with the DIOG that we have. And,
sure.
And once that Office of Origin tag comes down and we're the case agents, it's our case. So
that's right.
My pushback to my colleagues was, why are we waiting on them? But you guys, and they would even say, I hope they're going to decline the case. I hope that Washington tells us we can shut it down because I really don't think there's something here. I'm like, well, what's stopping us from closing the case out?
Right. Because you're OO, Officer Origin. Yeah. So what happened next then?
So this holding pattern continued and, just kind of keeping our fingers crossed that they're going to shut these cases down or, just reach a resolution. Finally, word comes out, email says, hey, everybody be available. We've got some arrests and search warrants that are going to be happening next week. It's going to be done simultaneously with some other subjects that are from the Tampa division. We're all going to hit them on the same day at the same time. So at that point, there's so much, hey, get ready. Now we're going to delay. Oh, hey, get ready. Now we're going to cancel. Mm-hmm. I figure with two field offices doing something simultaneously, everybody's pretty much committed at that point.
Right.
And to be honest, it was self-preservation to not raise a point before then. I was just kind of keeping my head down and doing my child porn work and hopefully, that these guys, everything gets resolved without having to involve myself in it.
Exactly. Good agent. Keep your head down. That's right. So the orders, did they come from headquarters then for the arrest warrants?
So arrests were going to get warrants had been obtained in Washington.
So they had. Okay.
Yes. And then they just it was a matter of getting the search warrants for the domiciles that were going to be searched in, in Florida with the respect with the Middle District of Florida. I wasn't involved as an affiant on either the arrest or the search warrants.
Okay.
But I knew it was a Friday. The takedowns were going to happen the following Wednesday.
Now, out of curiosity, did headquarters set the takedown day or did your office set the takedown day?
I don't know for a fact, but I would be fairly confident that it was going to be our headquarters just because of the SWAT's involvement.
Yeah.
That's going to be their asset to work out when they're going to do it. And they have to sort of talk to the SWAT team leader and the supervisor. Hey, when is this a good time to do it? What do you need? So most likely it was going to be coming from Jacksonville's and Tampa's senior executive staff deciding when they're going to do it.
Sure. So Washington wasn't pushing. They just said, here's your arrest warrants. Go out and do it. Yeah.
Go forth and multiply.
Yes.
Yep. So, and if Washington had been the Office of Origin, they could completely have cut a lead to our offices, just telling us, directing us to, execute it. But essentially there were our cases. So, there was definitely an inconsistency with the rules that, the DIOG spells out.
Right.
So I see that and know it's all right. The rubber's met the road now. I'm not comfortable with, the way that we're conducting these investigations. I'm not comfortable with even from what I saw that the means that we were going to be executing these, these arrests and search warrants. That is a legitimate tool. It is something that can be used and people of reasonable minds can disagree on, when is appropriate to use SWAT or not, but it is something that I felt as somebody who was a case agent on these cases I should have had some input on.
Yes.
And brought that all to my supervisor's attention the Friday before this Wednesday, the next week, was going to be happening.
May I ask, Agent Friend, how many cases were you the case agent on?
I was a case agent, not the, because there would be
several
of us on there. I know for a fact that on a couple of them that my name was. And they just did that when they was brought over because they wanted to make sure that I had access to the cases and could see them.
Right.
I hadn't drafted a case opening or anything like that. It was just a matter of plop Steve down as one of the case managers.
Excellent. So you didn't really provide any paperwork in the case file. The arrest warrants came from there, the background, everything. You as the SWAT person, however, do have input just in terms of the safety issues.
Well, I wasn't on the SWAT team in Jacksonville. I have 5 years of background and tactical experience and felt that gave me a little bit more insight as to when that resource is going to be used.
Why didn't they put you on the SWAT team since you had the experience?
They made that option available to me. My bigger boss, my wife, told me she didn't want me traveling around. So I opted to just be a regular agent.
I think that was wise. That's a wise move. That was a good move, Steve. Okay.
Happy wife, happy life.
No, yes. No, and I fully understand that and accept that. I was on SWAT in Seattle, so I fully understand where you're coming from. So you had the experience, so they must have honored that. Okay. And so your input was valuable because you had experience.
Mm-hmm. And I raised the concerns about using that and gave them some alternatives that I thought were pretty obvious to me.
Okay. What were your alternatives?
Number one is we've talked to the person and they have a lawyer. So what's stopping us from communicating with a lawyer to say, here's a summons or here's an arrest warrant, surrender yourself. If you want to take it up a level, why can't we have a local deputy knock on the door?
Okay.
If you want to take it up a level from there, why can't we use surveillance and interdict this guy when he's driving to work and he stops at a gas station?
Okay.
Get him out of the house. And so these are all viable and usable tools that I felt like weren't going to raise that SWAT was not necessary to use for
right.
And regardless of what the alleged criminal violation was, I have the Indian country experience. I've arrested 150 people. I've never used a SWAT team, and those were all violent criminals.
I fully believe you. I've been there, done it, and you're absolutely correct. And we certainly have the lessons of Ruby Ridge and Waco to fall back on in terms of how badly things can go wrong. So
I raised that exactly. I said, we're pretty lucky. What if SWAT shows up and the guy is coming back from a hunting trip, or the community just itself says, hey, I know Joe over there. He's a good dude. I don't care what he did that day. And now we have a community that's we're surrounded by. So
yeah, up in arms. Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. Learn from history. So you voiced these opinions to your supervisor or the SWAT person?
To my supervisor in the office, and then subsequently up the chain to ASACs and to the SAC of the field office.
And what were their comments regarding some of these ideas that you were providing?
My immediate supervisor was sympathetic to me, but said, these were lawful orders and we had to obey them. And, I needed to, think about how this was going to impact my career, and gave me the weekend to think about it. Came back Monday, said, I'm at peace with my decision. I got to obey my oath. I think that we're violating the oath. We're violating the training that we received on, civil rights abuses. And, we went to the Holocaust Museum. We went to the MLK Memorial, and that's it's incumbent on us to ring the alarm bells. So I had a subsequent meeting, a long one, with two of the ASACs for Jacksonville, expressed all these same sentiments to them that I've expressed to you and expressed to my supervisor, and heard some comments to me that were just really surprising.
Would you share them with our audience?
Yes.
Agent Friend, what were some of those comments?
So The one ASAC said, kept saying, you know, I was somebody that was on the sidelines in the stands, not in the game, and I didn't understand what was going on. He said that that I was a bad teammate to my coworkers. Mm-hmm. And then he got into the nitty gritty and questioned why I felt that people who killed police officers shouldn't be charged with a crime.
Okay.
So, I mean, I've followed these cases and I'm a regular American. So I read the news and to my knowledge, no police officers were killed on January 6th by any of the participants.
Correct.
So I pushed back and I said, look, you know, the big guy was Brian Sicknick. And that was the one that garnered all the media attention. That was the individual, the officer who was laid in state. And there was all this speculation that he got hit with a fire extinguisher, but that's all borne out to be false. And he died of a stroke and there was no police officers killed.
Right.
And there was this delayed response from the ASAC, and like it was something that he didn't know. And he said, he asked me, he said, where are you getting your information from?
Oh, no.
And I told him, I read the news. It's publicly available information. And then our conversation turned, you know, into, well, maybe people were seriously hurt. And I said, well, yeah, but you said killed. And that's different. And my general point that I was making to them was, I'm keeping with my training. I am in a situation here where I feel like that might be a lawful search warrant and arrest warrant, but I also have an oath to my office and I feel like they're in conflict with each other and I have to default to my oath of office, because if there's a due process problem here, the Sixth Amendment is in the Constitution. I've sworn an oath to uphold and protect it. The order that I'm getting is violating that. So I have to pick a road. I can't exercise both. And if I am going to participate in any way with these arrests that are coming down because of the way that the cases have been investigated and that well has been so poisoned, I feel like I'm going to be violating my oath of office.
Okay. So your oath of office, let's get into this here. Your oath of office, what was the part that you felt you were violating specifically?
My oath of office is to protect the Constitution of the United States.
And this was against the Constitution, according to your thinking?
Yes.
Okay. And how was it against the Constitution?
Well, the Sixth Amendment guarantees everyone due process. And mm-hmm. I felt that the FBI operating outside its own rules was effectively a due process violation. And I felt that the use of SWAT in the way that we've gone about interviewing people who we didn't have even anything up close to a reasonable suspicion that they had participated, I felt that that could potentially be construed as an Eighth Amendment violation where there was unusual and cruel and unusual punishment, where, you know, sitting down and even interviewing somebody who said, I was there, I walked in, the Capitol Police officer waved me in, I went in, I didn't do any damage, I tore it around and I left. And we have video and that verifies exactly what he said. I said, well, this man sitting here, he's retained an attorney, so he's financially been burdened. At the time, I thought, well, he's out of day as work. Turns out that his employer had fired him. So that's somebody who that this process has punished. And from what I could tell, he followed a lawful order from an officer. So even if he had committed a crime by being there and was indeed charged with it, it seemed to be like a cruel and unusual punishment for something that you know, his actions hadn't reached the level that he needed to be, you know, experiencing that.
Okay, excellent. That sets it up very clear, very, very clear in your mind. And that really helps, I think, people to understand where you're coming from. Let's be devil's advocate and ask you a few things, so if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
And yeah, and these are the tough questions, and these are the questions that people ask. What about a refusal to carry out orders? That's a concern, I think, to a lot of people, because if every agent had a right to just not carry out the orders they disagreed with, it would be a mess. We can agree on that, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So what about that idea that you shouldn't refuse an order?
Well, I have two responses. So okay. I think that the The order in this case was to carry out an arrest of a subject. That is a signed arrest warrant from a magistrate judge. It says law enforcement officers shall execute this. That's it doesn't correct. Say Steve Friend shall. And we have in the FBI, in law enforcement, if there's a conflict of interest, we can pull people off of operations all the time. I've been on operations where somebody, had a child that went to a school that was with another child whose parent was and that many degrees of separation. And we said, out of an abundance of caution, we have a conflict of interest here. We're going to make sure this individual is not involved.
Yes.
So when
Jane, this is Jason. Can I interrupt here for just a second?
Oh, of course, Jason. Something? Oh, Jason, please.
Do. Yeah. So there's an implication in your question or an assumption in your question that I'm not sure is factually accurate, which is, you're sort of presuming that Steve refused a direct order of some sort. I mean,
yes.
It's not as if they said you will go and hit this door, and he said no, I won't. That's not my understanding of the facts of what occurred. He was asking his supervisors. He was making protected disclosures about his reasonable basis to believe that there was a threat to public safety by using more aggressive tactics than necessary when there were other alternatives. That is a protected disclosure. He made that disclosure long before the operation was to occur. His supervisor's response to that was to tell him that he needed to question whether he needed to be an FBI agent. At that point, he hasn't refused a direct order, and they're threatening his career advancement already.
Oh, excellent point.
He seeks, right? And he seeks, he's seeking alternatives. He's volunteering to do other work. He's asking for leave that day. They're denying him that leave. They're telling him, and then they're putting him in an AWOL status. They didn't order him to to participate in that raid that day. They ordered him to stay home that day, and that's what he did. Steve followed orders.
Okay, is that true, Steve?
Yes. So after the meeting with my ASACs, and also I'd volunteered to sit on a wiretap that day, but we had up and running that needed to be manned. They said no, and they want. But after the meeting, received an email from them. They said that in light of my refusal to participate in lawful arrest and search operation, that I was deemed to be not to report to work the next day, and I would be placed in absent without leave status.
Ah.
So I did not report. I had on my timesheet entered myself as absent without leave, even though I've been told not to come in, and
yes.
was docked that day's pay on my next pay stub.
Wow. Okay. They were getting serious right off the bat.
Yes.
So yes. So there was no refusal on your part, but they said due to your refusal.
Correct.
Okay. So are you saying that they jumped to an assumption that you were refusing and, went to that quickly when you actually did not refuse? Is that what you're saying?
Well, they jumped to marking me out without having an opportunity to perform other duties as necessary. But I have to be honest, I told them that, look, I have a moral objection here. If you tell me that I need to be there, I would not show, because that's unprofessional. I would call you and say that I'm not coming so you can prepare to have another person in that role, because that to me felt like a professional thing to do. But I said participating in any way to me was going to be a moral problem.
Gotcha. I gotcha. So it sounds all reasonable so far. Sounds extremely reasonable. Let's move on to the next one, which is there is an internal system which would allow you to give your complaints to. Did you ever utilize that? I know that we're talking about a time period that's very short, but have you utilized the internal system?
No, I haven't.
Okay. I was curious about that. And then also,
Wait a minute, Jane.
Oh,
what do you mean? Wait a minute, Jane. What do you mean? Sorry, this is Jason again. What do you mean by that internal system? You mean, did he report in anywhere internally? He did report to the OIG.
Okay. Excellent. So he did report to the IG, DOJ. Jane,
this is Dan. So I can clarify that.
No.
I advise my FBI agents who are clients, there's two places where the disclosures can be sent under the CFR regs on this. One is the OPR, and you always do it up your chain of command, but one is the OPR and one is the Department of Justice IG. I don't have a lot of confidence in OPR's ability to handle internal disclosures and complaints. I just have had a really rocky experience with them, with other FBI employees, including special agents.
Oh, yes.
So my preference is always to have the client go to, in this case, Michael Horowitz, the Department of Justice IG, because I think they're a little more removed from the culture of the Bureau, the bad side of the culture of the Bureau, which sometimes tends to bend the processes towards conformity rather than lifting up and celebrating special agents who bring forth disclosures. And given that the exclusion of Steven started very early on, as soon as he raised the issue, that's what you and he were just discussing with Jason. You could see the pattern of reprisal already beginning as he had raised these concerns. All of a sudden, they're going to box him out. They're going to remove him from their circle of trust because they don't approve of the whistleblowing he had just conducted. So seeing that, I'm already seeing that type of behavior in the rank and file, I would rather get these issues to Michael Horowitz, have him do the review, and then move forward with however we have to engage with OPR after that.
You're very wise. As Jason knows deeply, any complaints to OPR is like throwing something down a dark well and watching it disappear. And Michael Horowitz has been a friend to whistleblowers. So I think you're very wise in pursuing that route. I obviously, through experience, you know that. Agent Friend, you have two war horses who know what they're doing. There's no two ways about it. They've been through it, and they've got the scars to show it. I would really like to ask you, though, about the FBI being a liberal organization. I don't know if that was something the media pushed out there or if you felt that way, because a lot of people don't think that the FBI is liberal.
I've never said anything like that at all.
Ah, was that the media that said that?
I believe just in light of the representative and senators that have come forward with my complaint being Republican, that's probably a media talking point. But I think it is important to know that I sent my complaint to Senator Durbin's office also because I wanted to make sure that all sides had access to it. And that's very important to me.
Oh, that is important. That is important. So this is not, I noticed that the politicians have really gotten involved and tried to paint this as liberals against conservatives. Is that what you have seen them do? Because anyone with a half a mind here knows that the FBI is extremely conservative. Do we agree on that point?
I don't know. I think I've been lucky that I've worked with people that are pretty apolitical in their work. In their private lives, I mean, I'm sure they have conversations, but you know, in my last office in Iowa, I can tell you for a fact that I worked with somebody that was maybe a little to the left of Bernie Sanders and had no problem with that. And I worked with other people that were, you know, in their private time canvassing for Republicans for office and had no problem with that. So I think the political persuasions of agents, you know, might span the gambit of, you know, what all over the place. To me, the ultimate dead center, I say, hey, I'm a centrist. I believe in the Constitution. That's a central.
And that's excellent. So,
Jane, this is Jason again. So,
Jason.
I think this is one of the problems with how, you know, we seem to be unable to talk and think about these things as a society these days. Is, you know, everyone is sort of anxious to bring in, you know, the political motivations or aspects to, you know, and read on to that and bring to whatever conversation you're having, you know, and impose that on that conversation. And it's almost impossible to break through and hear, you know, something and evaluate it on its own merits, regardless of, you know, what people's personal political opinions are. And, you know, I think this is, you know, some of the stuff that you had read about broad characterizations of the FBI that Steve never made, you know, that may be a symptom of that, you know.
He made his
disclosures. He made his protected disclosures to his supervisors. He made them to the inspector general. He made them to the Office of Special Counsel. And he made them to both sides, the Democrat and the Republican, the Democrat chair and the Republican ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is the FBI's primary and most senior oversight committee in the United States Senate. That's where he made his disclosures. It's true that Senator Grassley is the one who followed up and wrote a letter to the director about it, along with Senator Johnson. Senator Durbin did not. I don't know why Senator Durbin chose not to do that. I'm not going to question his motives or allege that, you know, some kind of political bias there, but those are the facts. Senator Durbin didn't follow up and Senator Grassley did. That's not Steve's fault. Steve can't help that.
No. And Steve. Yes. Go ahead, Dan.
Jane, I was going to add something on to it. And being Steve's attorney, I'm going to say that this is my interpretation. I haven't cleared this with Steve yet. I think the best way to look at this is not left versus right, but in some respects, establishment versus constitutionalist, Steve being the constitutionalist. I think the establishment within the FBI, and particularly in the last 5 years, they were under a lot of stress. They're in a very difficult situation, not unlike some of our special forces units and not unlike the Secret Service. And these elite public institutions, and the FBI is an elite public institution, when you're under a lot of pressure, in 2016 was an awful year for the FBI. Just lots of bad headwork and lots of bad places. And how you work through those decisions, there are healthy ways and there are unhealthy ways. And my fear is that there's been an unhealthy working out of the legacy of 2016, which is left in the FBI, an entrenched establishment, which is taking what I would consider a very right-leaning approach, which is to squash all dissent possible without, you know, vetting the possible allegations the way they need to be vetted, which is particularly problematic in a law enforcement role because law enforcement cuts its bread and butter from sourcing, right? It's the protection of sources which allows an institution to be able to follow up, figure out whether abuse is going on, whether that's constitutional abuse of the Eighth Amendment or the Fourth Amendment or the Sixth Amendment, or whether it's child pornography. Okay, it's the same sort of process of vetting out those sources. So I think it's down to the lower level of granularity. It's, you know, this is investigative misconduct that needs to be looked at.
Excellent point. So just to make this real clear to myself, everyone who's listening, Agent Friend was not establishing this as a left versus right situation or in any political sense. He's simply saying, I have an objection to this based in constitutional law. He did not bring up this, it's a right versus left or left versus right. Is that correct,
based
Steve?
On the yes, based on the constitutional concerns as well as, you know, I don't leave out the public safety concerns. I mean, the core of what he's saying is there were less dangerous ways to execute this law enforcement mission. And, you know, given his background on SWAT, he has a reasonable basis to say that. It's not just the constitutional issue, but yeah.
Excellent. Okay. I see what you're saying. What would happen if every agent had an objection? What would happen to the Bureau? Do you know what I'm saying? If go ahead, Steve. Wonder if the whole SWAT team had a problem of some sort. You'd have no SWAT.
Yeah, you could. I mean, you could have that intellectual conversation, but I think, you know, you could say, what if every trucker had an objection to, you know, fuel standards?
Yes.
And then just stop driving. So I mean,
ultimately, Jane, that is the check on abuses of authority in any sort of regime, you know, any sort of government that is, overstepping its bounds toward, in that authoritarian direction, right? I mean, the ultimate check is always, are the people who are actually with the guns going to follow the orders, right?
That is
excellent. You know, I can't imagine the entire SWAT team objecting, you know, if it wasn't reasonable to object. And so I see that as sort of a protection for liberty, right? I mean, if the entire SWAT team objected, there's probably something wrong. That would be my reply.
Yeah, I can see the next step the Bureau's going to take is dropping that darn tour of the Holocaust Museum. Obviously, doesn't go right down their alley of thought. You know, in the past, that's their worst fear, you know, that people would stand up and say, wait, this is wrong. But, you know, in the past, certainly during the time of Fred Whitehurst and myself, they would have used they would send you away for fitness for duty because they would have thought you were crazy. But they didn't do it in this case. I've noticed that after there was a battle fought over fitness for duty, now they're turning to yanking security clearances. And this has been their mode for, I'd say, the last 5 years, I think, which has been
absolutely correct, Jane. Yeah. We have seen, both Dan and I have seen it in other cases. They do it because they know that there's no oversight, no independent review, no accountability, not even a judge. You know,
nothing.
Courts don't even want to second guess a security clearance determination.
That's right.
There's always this thing in their back pocket. Well, we've got some secret information that you don't have, and we have to protect our sources for that information so you can't see it. You know, well, if anybody with any kind of civil libertarian streak, that just doesn't fly. There's got to be some kind of independent oversight and accountability on that process. It can't be entirely in control of the people who make decisions with nobody else being able to review it.
So that is correct.
Jane, there's a very important point on this.
Sure.
As you probably know from your experience, our security adjudications are stovepiped. There's quite a few security offices, and some are combined together. The defense have their consolidated adjudications. But by and large, the agencies are all independently operating. And that means that you can have really deviant cultures, subcultures arise, particularly in the portions of the executive branch where there is no judicial oversight. So for the Defense Department, if Steve was a special agent with the Defense Criminal Investigative Service, a unit I used to work with quite frequently in my early career, then he would have access to an administrative law judge over the Defense Office of Hearing Appeals. So as the security clearance process percolated up through review, several levels of review in the Defense Department, by and large, you get really good decision-making. And those judges are heroes and heroines over in Falston when they do that. Unfortunately, that doesn't exist in particularly two agencies, Langley and at the FBI. It's a very incestuous decision-making process.
Yes, it is.
And the last I heard was the Access Review Committee over the FBI had not met in the last 3 years.
That's right.
And so there's a question about whether there even is a review process in the FBI, which, of course, is a due process standard, which may get around some of the legal restrictions on reviewing security clearance work. But there's no question, if you want to bag and tag somebody, the way you do it is you open up something as a security issue that is, in fact, really a personnel issue. And frankly, if I go back to my days in the Navy as a division officer, you know, what should have happened was better coaching, a little reconciliation, maybe a little bit on the deck plates mediation, so that Steve's concerns could be accommodated, the mission could be accomplished, and people stepped aside from their egos and behaved in a manner that we expect an elite institution to behave. So, and that's why I'm quite concerned. My hope is that the reprisal allegations at Steve will help push this, against Steve will help push this to a review. And I think it's appropriate for the director to step in right now and say, okay, yeah, great, we have all these processes, but let's do the right thing, get this agent back on the job, review the allegations, and let's set aside this quasi-litigation process that got set up in a really bad way, you know, almost 15 years ago. So that's my thought on the security clearance process.
No, I wish you much luck on that, because we've seen it change from using fitness for duty, which we fought them every tooth and nail, and now they switch to security clearances. I wish you much luck, because they're using it just to oppress agents, to take them out with no, there's no stress for them, for the Bureau. And you know, here they have this really great agent who is stuck here in this limbo. So I wish you much luck on that. And Special Agent Friend, please, we're coming to an end here, but share with us your feelings. I feel bad for you because I know that the Bureau, if nothing else, they love to make an example out of somebody. And they have a history of quashing whistleblowers just like bugs. I mean, they're ruthless, they're territorial, and it's ugly. And I wish you a pleasant future, at least, because it gets quite ugly. Share your final thoughts with us, would you please?
Yes, and thank you again for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to get this out. I said multiple times, I hope that you know, my colleagues at the FBI really dig deep into their hearts and consider the fidelity, bravery, integrity motto and what it means to them and how serious raising your hand and swearing mm-hmm. that oath is. And to the public at large, you know, the overriding thing that drove me to come out with my complaint about the manipulated Office of Origin on the cases. Here's my concern at large is that because if I sit across the table from you, Jane, and when we have a conversation about something like energy policy or tax rates, we can disagree, we can come to a compromise, we can just have a great conversation. But we can't have that if you think that I'm a member of the Taliban. Mm-hmm. And because of the way that the statistics have been manipulated, there's now going to be a thought that half the country are violent extremist terrorists, and they're going to be barred from having that conversation. And the nation can't abide that. We can't exist if that happens. So that was really, I'm a believer in our country. I'm a believer in the Constitution. And that's why I swore an oath to protect it. So I'll leave you with that. And I thank you very much for the chance to talk.
And Agent Friend, I wish you good luck. And our hearts are with you. And we have a whistleblower support group if you need any help. And I thank Daniel Meyer, your attorney, and Jason Foster, who has long helped whistleblowers. I wish you all good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Jane.
You have been listening to Whistleblower of the Week, a program hosted by Whistleblower Network News. Please consider making a donation to support programs like this. Visit whistleblowersblog.org/support for more information.